I guess just to first highlight how much our domestic environment has changed. Some of you may not be aware that last week, virtually all of the Indo-Pacific chiefs of the Defense Forces met in Sydney, and the very first item on the agenda for those discussions was climate change. So that's a huge and refreshing change to see that that is so prominently featured now in a meeting co-hosted by Australia and the United States. I was asked by Ian to comment on some of the risks of undertaking a climate impact assessment, the risks of conducting the assessment itself, the mistakes that could be made. And some of them were actually highlighted by Daniel, but I'll just run through these very briefly and happy to get into more detail during the discussion. So there may be five that I'd highlight. Some of these are quite general, some are more specific. The first is a tendency to view national security too narrowly. And I should say, I don't think the team that's currently leading this risk assessment is going to make this mistake, at least in any significant way. There's absolutely no doubt that climate change is going to have enormous impacts on traditional security issues, impacts on the Australian Defence Forces, including threatening military infrastructure and readiness, and also exacerbating tensions in places that are already military hotspots like the South China Sea, where sea level rise is amplifying disputes over maritime boundaries and fisheries as well. But as I think Daniel pointed out in the Chatham House study, the most pressing regional security threats are not going to be coming from these traditional national security areas, but they're more likely to be linked to disruptions in social systems, and particularly the food, water, and energy nexus. And the latest IPCC report, that's the UN reports produced by the best scientists in the world that focus on these problems, has particularly highlighted that nexus as an area of concern: food, water, and energy security. For Australia conducting a risk assessment, it means when you consider issues like food, water, energy, trade, health, biosecurity, it becomes pretty clear that any risk assessment that is essentially managed and involving the traditional security departments, whether it's defense, ONI, foreign affairs, home affairs, is going to fall short, because clearly these issues are issues that affect a whole broad array of government agencies that need to be involved. A second related issue is that a risk assessment shouldn't underestimate the domestic links. The review also needs to consider the links between climate risks originating outside of Australia and domestic impacts of climate change. And if it does ignore that, then it's overlooking the possibility of initiatives such as the one Brendan O'Connor mooted during the campaign, which was that Labor might establish a national civilian disaster response force to free up the defense force to meet what he also saw was intensifying military threats abroad, more traditional military threats. And so any risk assessment that is focused too narrowly on the outside world, the risks that are emerging outside the world, are missing the connections between the domestic response with defense. Everyone in Australia would appreciate, is increasingly becoming engaged in these national scale disasters that climate change is contributing to significantly. A third pitfall is to underestimate the systemic nature of the climate change threat. And that's one reason maritime Southeast Asia, the sub-region on our northern border here in Australia, has been overlooked as a climate change hotspot. Most analysis of climate impacts tend to focus on individual hazards, say rising temperatures, rather than on the fact that many things are happening at once in this systemic change. So, for example, if you look at a lot of the studies done in the IPCC looked at on climate adaptation, they might focus a study might focus on how rising temperature is reducing food production, but not on the compounding impacts of other hazards like floods, droughts, fires, increase in pests, saltwater inundation, cyclones, big population displacements, how all of these things that are happening simultaneously as the system changes with climate will undermine food security. So it is really important. It's analytically extremely difficult to do this. In fact, these systemic disruptions have radical uncertainty associated with them. But if we don't get a grip on this, and there are various ways we can do this, as the Chatham House study attempted to do it, as I'm sure our colleagues in the Australian government will be trying to do as well. But if we don't get a handle on these cascadings, the systemic change, we're really going to misjudge the true scale of the challenge that we face. I think the review also needs to take account of how rapidly major societal impacts are going to begin appearing. In effect, the changes are now happening non-linearly. What that means in terms of human nature is it's sort of human nature to assume that the pace of change we've seen over the last 10 years is what we can expect over the next 10 years. But that would be a mistake to assume that, because the pace of change is accelerating. And let me just illustrate this with a couple of quick points. Extreme heat events have mushroomed 90-fold over the past 10 years relative to the 30 years from 1950 to 1980. So a huge dramatic increase, and the scale of that increase will continue as the climate continues to warm. And just to give you one other illustration of this, severe 1-in-100-year floods are very rapidly becoming annual events in many parts of the world. And that's particularly the case in maritime Southeast Asia, where sea levels rising at the fastest pace globally. So you have, with just a 10 centimeter change in sea level, increase in sea level, you have what was a 1-in-100-year event becoming a 1-in-33-year event. And we're on track for something like 50 centimeters by 2050. The pace of that change is even faster, as I mentioned, in the tropics and in Southeast Asia in particular. And so we will see these 1-in-100-year events becoming annual events very rapidly. In little more than a decade, that will start happening in places like Indonesia. Now, the Prime Minister Albanese said, the Shadow Prime Minister Albanese said during the campaign that this review needs to be completed within about 4 months. Now, I suspect it will take a bit longer, as it did in the U.S., in the U.S.'s process to do their reviews. But the government has committed to regularly updating it, and that's a great thing. But meeting a short deadline like that is going to require shortcuts. It will increase the likelihood that the teams managing this will take shortcuts. And maybe a fifth pitfall to identify is that the team really has to avoid the temptation to oversimplify the process. It would be unfortunate, for example, if the final report was, in essence, a process that involved developing the shared terms of reference across government and then giving it to each individual department to produce their response to those terms of reference and then essentially collating the result at a whole of government level. Climate risks don't fit neatly into these bureaucratic silos. In fact, if you could put on a pair of glasses that would enable us to see climate risk, it would be shooting in every direction across multiple government departments, globally, regionally, nationally, and subnationally here in Australia as well. So ideally, the process should begin with, and Daniel actually I noted this in terms of the Chatham House approach, with identifying what are the key national interests we're concerned about. And then, you know, whatever those objectives are, securing borders, energy security, countering terrorism or violent extremism, any of those things, and which will often, many of these key objectives will affect more than one government department, for example. And then those objectives should be the reference point for the review, with the relevant government agencies working together to flesh out those risks and whole of government responses. So have that integrated at the beginning. I think just to maybe finish with an emphasis on our own immediate region, the Indo-Pacific, because it is clearly a hotspot of overlapping hazards. If you look at the IPCC work that's been done and a lot of the scientific work, whether it's on sea level rise or extreme heat or decrease in fish catch potential or effects on food, you look at each one of those and you look at the maps of the world that where they're identifying the major impacts, each of them individually are settling on the region to our immediate north, maritime Southeast Asia and Southeast Asia more broadly. So it is a hotspot of overlapping climate hazards that in this climate change that's increasing non-linearly is going to be profoundly destabilizing in our region. And I should just point out, this is the same region that it is in the arc of fire, the ring of fire, which is the most geologically active region in the world. So you have, again, you have these climate impacts happening in a place, in a region that is already at the highest risk, geological risk, from volcanoes, earthquakes. Indonesia and the Philippines account for 80% of global volcanic risk, just the two countries. So a huge challenge. I just wanted to highlight a few of these pitfalls to avoid. I'm confident that many of them are being avoided, and I'm hoping all of them will be avoided as part of this initial, really critical attempt, first attempt to develop our national risk assessment. Thanks. Yeah, it's an interesting question. The study that I think some people have referred to in the Q&A that's just come out about catastrophic climate change has highlighted the need to focus on the fat tail of the risk. And I think not all of the evidence, but a lot of the recent science actually leads us in that direction to focus on that. Because if we look at reasons for concern in the IPCC report, there are a number of categories of reasons for concern. Every update of the climate science has determined that we have underestimated the risks in each of those. And so, and there are much science that has recently come out that is talking about the unanticipated. Well, there's some well-known tipping points, but unanticipated connections between, say, the increase in heat and drought and the outbreak of fires and the links between that and increased greenhouse gas emissions or, the methane as well. There's some new studies that have just come out on that as well. So I think the risks, even though if we look at commitments countries have made, it does seem as though if they carry out all their commitments that will limit warming to just, and I'm putting just in quotes, 2 to 3 degrees, 2 to 3 degrees is potentially catastrophic as well. At least the science is pointing in that direction.
Yeah, thanks, Rob. Chris or Cheryl?
Well, I'll have a go if you like. I think the really interesting thing, arcing back over a few decades, is how much more quickly the events that we feared are happening to us. And in some cases, it's not the single event, it's a succession of events over a short period of time that's having a huge impact. And the way I conceive of it is, in the noughties, for example, we all thought there was plenty of time to put in place systems to deal with the issues. Well, frankly, my look at the trends tells me there's no time left, that even today, the urgency of the task to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions and try to keep global warming to under 2 degrees Celsius is slipping by with every day. And the way I conceive of it, if I was unlucky enough to live, let's say in the flood zone in Lismore or southeast Queensland or in western Sydney, it's not going to be very long with a few more of these events, and I'm going to get really angry. And so to go back to the point that that Robert and Daniel were making, there are going to be some very significant domestic issues to be dealt with here that need to be addressed. If I look back, I just say, and it picks up on the point that Robert just made, if you look at every increasing IPCC report, it gets worse and worse and worse. What we do know is, in the early days, we tended to head for the comfortable middle probabilities. We never looked at the most extreme events, and we had the comfort of thinking, and we were complacent about the future. That's all disappeared. And as we rewrite that, I think it's looking very threatening over the next 10 to 15 years. And I just don't think we've got the time anymore to simply let a selected group of people in our communities deal with it. If we don't mobilise our communities to help deal with the issue now, then I think we might be writing a very different history.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Chris. There's another element to this, I think, that hasn't received much attention, which I think has been raised in the Q&A, and that's the psychological end of this. We're talking about very big changes that are occurring already. The acceptance of that within society obviously has been, to put it mildly, somewhat lacking. And I think, there's still a large proportion of the community who don't believe this is actually happening.